Quiet pays. You are now in the loop. No excuses. 5.4.2.2. People first. The quiet ones say, save me from the bullpen. Ms. Kane takes on another of my principal bugbears, the breathless promotion of open offices. I cannot do her case justice in this brief summary, but perhaps I can sow one or two seeds of doubt in what has become conventional wisdom. Consider this powerful statement in quiet from Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. Most inventors and engineers I have met are like me, and they're shy and they live in their heads. They work best alone and where they can control an invention's design. I'm going to give you some advice that might be hard to take. Work alone. You're going to be best able to design revolutionary products and features. More from quiet. Open plan workers are more likely to suffer from high blood pressure and elevated stress levels and get the flu. They argue more with their colleagues. Introverts seem to know these things intuitively and resist being herded together. Also from quiet, video game design company Backbone Entertainment's creative director. We switched over to cubicles from a warehouse format, and we're worried about it. You'd think in a creative environment people would hate that, but it turns out they prefer having nooks and crannies they can hide away in and be away from everybody. Three quotes doth not a case make, but they do, I hope, raise questions. Disclaimer. Ignore me on this topic if you wish. I admit to despising the very mention of open offices. I would sooner die than work in an open office. Well, maybe that's a bit extreme. But then again, maybe it's not. David Berkus, in his superb book, Under New Management, titled one chapter, Close Open Offices. Works for me. 5.5. People first. Getting really serious about evaluation. Evaluating people effectively equals number one differentiator. After superb results during his first decade as CEO, Jack Welch finally convinced Wall Street that GE was more than an unclassifiable ragtag conglomerate. He said a large part of the GE difference was a unique capability to developing great leader managers. The results of his people development success, he said, were worth tens of billions of dollars in market capitalization. The market agreed. And at the center of that management development excellence was unique attention to and skill at evaluation. McKinsey's Ed Michaels gave a flavor of the GE process in his book, The War for Talent. In most companies, the talent review process is a farce. At GE, Jack Welch and his two top HR people visited each division for a day. They reviewed the top 20 to 50 people by name. They talked about talent pool strengthening issues. The talent review process is a contact sport at GE. It has the intensity and the importance of the budget process at most companies. Interestingly, Welch's successor, Jeff Immelt, who was no Welch clone, also said that the evaluation process is contributor number one to the company's success. Powerful, eh? And, alas, I agree with Michaels that most review processes are spineless and do not focus on the overall quality of the talent pool, which is not to say that GE always got it right. Some practices, for example, encompassed unvarnished verbal brutality. Immelt made a great number of long overdue changes in that regard. But the intensity, seriousness, and strategic importance of the process remains undiminished. Some thoughts on evaluations. Do football coaches or theater directors use a standard HR evaluation form to assess their players or actors? Stupid question, eh? The whole point in these instances is to build on the differences and cherish the peculiarities. Same-same templates should be avoided at all costs. Does the CEO use a standard evaluation form for her VPs? If not, then why use one for frontline employees? Standardized evaluation forms are as wrong-headed for assessing the 10 baristas at a Starbucks shop as for assessing Starbucks' 10 top vice presidents. I am dead serious about this. Again, see above. The idea is to create an interesting team that provides memorable customer experiences. Interesting differences in personality are as important as similarities on dimensions such as, say, demonstrated punctuality. Each of your 8 direct reports has an utterly unique professional trajectory. How could a standardized evaluation form serve any useful purpose? Effective evaluations emerge from a series of loosely structured, continuing conversations, not from filling out a form once every 6 months or year. Boss, does it take you at least a day to prepare for a 1-hour evaluation meeting? If not, you are not very serious about the meeting or the employee being evaluated. Boss, if you are not exhausted after an evaluation conversation, then it wasn't a serious conversation. I am not keen on formal programs that identify high potential employees. As a manager, I will treat all team members as possible high potentials. High-PO programs have a history of demotivating the other 95%. I have no problem with a shared checklist to guide the evaluation conversation, but the off-list discussion will by far be the most important element of the exchange. Central to an evaluation conversation are company values and culture. How, be very explicit, does the person being evaluated adhere to and inject energy into the company culture and values? Topic number 1 for a boss of bosses. What is her or his leadership development track record? This should be examined before the session in exacting detail. Message number 1. People are not standardized. Their evaluations should not be standardized. Ever. Damn it. Wrap up. Can you honestly call yourself an evaluation pro? If not, how do you become one? Study, practice, coaching, feedback. Boss, this is what the hell you do for a living. Mastery is extremely difficult. Excellence in evaluation, I suggest, is as complex as excellence in neurosurgery. There is not a hint of exaggeration in that statement. Recap. Leadership may involve vision, authenticity, and so on, but in the main, and the source of managers' and leaders' highest impact, is stuff. That is, discrete tasks such as hiring and evaluating. And, frankly, very few managers' leaders merit the word pro when it comes to these discrete tasks that are the real meat and potatoes of their job. 5.6. Big data. HR genius, HR madness, HR's future. From Liram Siegel, Aaron Goldstein, Jay Goldman, and Rahaf Harfouch, The Decoded Company, Know Your Talent Better Than You Know Your Customers. DPSS, Data Powered Sixth Sense. Radical insights into what makes your people work. A decoded company with the right systems in place can collect all of the required data to provide organizational proprioception, digital body language, to your people, giving them that background sense of what neighboring departments and teams are doing, as well as that of the efforts of their team members. We think of this as eliminating blind spots. To me, the excerpt above reads word for word like a passage from George Orwell's 1984. At the very least, it amounts to playing, keyword, playing, with fire, or in this instance, playing with people. In short order, artificial intelligence and big data have plunged headlong and at flank speed into the world of human resources. While there is doubtless much of value, there are also extraordinary downsides, or at least potential downsides. From the above, as well as that of the efforts of their team members, AI, per an idea such as this, will have the power to monitor, literally, virtually every breath and grimace and grin you make, and compare the results to that of your teammates. While I can possibly imagine some increase in ability to coordinate some activities, what stands out to me, among other things, is what feels like a perfect tool for crushing individuality and creativity at precisely the wrong moment. That is, a moment where creativity is becoming key number one to differentiation and job retention. As to my comment about, quote, playing, unquote, being the key word, most of the HR software is, in my opinion, less than adequately tested. To be sure, it has been carefully vetted by its producers, but the mid to long-term impact on the likes of creativity and the human spirit in general is simply unknown. I will only offer one scenario concerning the intrusiveness that awaits us. It comes courtesy of Eric Siegel's Predictive Analytics, The Power to Predict Who Will Click, Buy, Lie, or Die. Flash forward to dystopia. You work in a chic cubicle, sucking chicken-flavored sustenance from a tube. You're furiously maneuvering with a joystick. Your boss stops by and gives you a look. We need to talk about your loyalty to this company. The organization you work for has deduced that you might be planning to quit. The AI big data model predicts your plans and intentions possibly before you have even conceived them. In short, the AI algorithm, based upon information of God knows what flavor from God knows how many organizations, has perhaps discerned from a careful analysis of every keystroke you've made, each stored in an electronic corporate big data cloud vault, that your choice of phraseology in emails and instant messages is consistent with phraseology used by people who have quit their jobs. Yes, the infinite correlations among big data collected from some enormous planetary population knows what you are thinking, as Mr. Siegel says, perhaps before you do. Telltales are not primarily obvious, like the use of the word headhunter. It's typically more subtle, such as an increase in using the phrase bureaucratic bullshit, or a jump in the percentage of times you go out to lunch rather than stay in. This is no fantasy. Siegel's example is derived from a Hewlett-Packard flight risk model developed by the company's HR unit. In summary, some very wise souls insist that we are entering a brave new future of AI-determined organization and work structuring. I have no doubt that tools such as DPSS or the HP flight risk algorithm may contribute to, say, a rapid short-term productivity increase. But I unequivocally draw the line at the notion that effective organizing and staffing for tomorrow is destined to be algorithmically optimized, to use a term that appeared in a McKinsey article. For one big thing, the primary defenses against AI-driven job destruction are widespread, relatively unconstrained creativity and novel organizational arrangements designed to produce products and services that will stand out in an automated world. I unequivocally believe that such creativity is antithetical to algorithmic optimization of human affairs. The game is on. The stakes are ludicrously high for organizations and individuals, and too many of us are asleep at the switch, in particular, thoughtlessly purchasing and implementing powerful, minimally tested tools. If I were able to issue a single command on this topic, it would be to beg you to read carefully Kathy O'Neill's extraordinary book, Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. The title suggests oceanic issues accompanying the untrammeled use of big data, inequality and democracy. And Dr. O'Neill, who is a math PhD from Harvard, delivers chilling evidence to support her concerns. Included in the book are two brilliant chapters on HR software. They contain example piled upon example of unintended consequences of the promiscuous use of big data in HR settings. Perhaps the most important point is that these tools mess with us and are effectively untested on dimensions that matter to long-term business success or failure and to the way we treat our fellow human beings. 5.7. People first. Promoting is a life or death matter. Promotions are life and death decisions. Peter Drucker, from his book, The Practice of Management. Drucker says life and death decisions. The sentiment is hard to argue with. As I see it, a leader at any given level makes on average two key promotion decisions every year. If she or he is in a job for 5 years, say, that adds up to 10 promotion decisions. In short, and at the end of the day, those 10 promotion decisions are her principal legacy. Do most leaders take promotion decisions seriously? Absolutely. But the question is, do they take them seriously enough? In general, in perhaps 9 out of 10 cases, I would say no. For example, as I see it, a promotion decision is a close kin to an acquisition decision. You, chief deciding on who gets promoted, are effectively going to anoint someone or someone else with the wholesale responsibility, ownership, for the future performance of a vital segment of the organization. He or she, regardless of the formal language on the organization chart, will in effect become CEO of XYZ division, CEO of training department, CEO of customer service, etc. You'd spend months on an acquisition decision of even a tiny company. And I believe a promotion that turns a company or division or department over to Ms. X or Mr. Y should get more or less the same degree of attention. Considerations. Promotion key number one. Obviously, I wish it were so in practice, the number one consideration in the promotion is demonstrated people development skills. Be very thorough, systematic, and precise in assessing these skills. For example, interview, in particular, graduates. People in the candidate's charge who have moved on, one hopes, to greater things. How well did Ms. X prepare her for that next job or promotion? Promotion key number two. The second primary consideration is the work culture that Mr. Y has established in his current assignment. In particular, has it been an energetic, civil, innovative, execution-focused environment? Promotion key number three. In crazy 2018, promotions are arguably more important than ever. One interesting take on this comes from risk management professional David Rothkopf. Character is more crucial now than ever. Because in times of great uncertainty, past performance is no indicator of future performance. Experience falls away, and all you're left with is character. Summary. Life and death decisions. Two per year equals legacy. Number one, number two, number three equals people development, culture, character. Read. Study. Profit Through Putting People First Business Book Club. Business by and large has a lousy rep, and management books by and large focus on things that are broken and how to fix them. Yet there is also a robust body of good news by putting people really first books, like the informal list below. How about a year-long Profit Through Putting People First Business Book Club for you and or your leadership team? Nice Companies Finish First, Why Cutthroat Management is Over and Collaboration is In, by Peter Shankman and Karen Kelly. uncontainable, how passion, commitment, and conscious capitalism built a business where everyone thrives, by Kip Tyndall. Conscious Capitalism, Liberating the Heroic Spirit of Business, by John Mackey and Raj Sisodia. Firms of Endearment, How World-Class Companies Profit from Passion and Purpose, by Raj Sisodia, Jag Sheth, and David Wolf. The Good Job Strategy, How the Smartest Companies Invest in Employees to Lower Costs and Boost Profits, by Zeynep Tan. Joy, Inc., How We Built a Workplace That People Love, by Richard Sheridan. Joy at Work, A Revolutionary Approach to Fun on the Job, by Dennis Bakke. Employees First, Customers Second, Turning Conventional Management Upside Down, by Vineet Nair. The Customer Comes Second, Put Your People First and Watch 'Em Kick Butt, by Hal Rosenbluth. Patience Comes Second, Leading Change by Changing the Way You Lead, by Paul Spiegelman and Britt Barrett. It's Your Ship, Management Techniques from the Best Damn Ship in the Navy, by D. Michael Abrashoff. Turn This Ship Around, How to Create Leadership at Every Level, by David Marquette. Small Giants, Companies That Choose to Be Great Instead of Big, by Bo Burlingham. Hidden Champions of the 21st Century, The Success Strategies of Unknown World Market Leaders, by Herman Simon. Retail Superstars, Inside the 25 Best Independent Stores in America, by George Whalen. The Soft Edge, Where Great Companies Find Lasting Success, by Rich Karlgaard. Everybody Wins, The Story and Lessons Behind REMAX, by Phil Harkins and Keith Holohan. The Dream Manager, by Matthew Kelly. Delivering Happiness, A Path to Profits, by Tony Hsieh. Camellia, A Very Different Company, a company publication. Fans, Not Customers, How to Create Growth Companies in a No-Growth World, by Vernon Hill. Like a Virgin, Secrets They Won't Teach You at Business School, by Richard Branson. Good Business, Leadership, Flow, and the Making of Meaning, by Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. Enough, The Measures of Money, Business, and Life, by John Bogle. An Everyone Culture, Becoming a Deliberately Developmental Organization, by Robert Kagan and Lisa Lasco Leahy. Chapter 6, A Mania for Training. My Story. Much as I hate to admit it, I am a second-rate athlete. All little boys are supposed to dream about making it to the major leagues. But me, I dreamed of making it from third-string guard to second-string guard on the junior varsity high school football team. Well, I was never a star for sure. But the fact is that in 1962, I became the starting goalie on the Cornell varsity lacrosse team. And the answer in two words is Ned Harkness. I played lacrosse from about the age of 8 or 9. That was requisite if you grew up in Maryland. I worked hard but didn't seem to get very far. See my opening comment above. But I did keep at it. Made it to my high school varsity team. Made it to my Cornell freshman team. Hung in and hung on. Then a magical thing happened. Ned Harkness became the coach of the Cornell varsity lacrosse team, where I, in my sophomore year, was a second or third stringer. Ned had won national collegiate championships in both lacrosse and hockey. He became, among other things, a successful National Hockey League coach. At Cornell, he was the varsity hockey coach, but when the prior lacrosse coach left suddenly early in the 1962 season, Ned filled in for the rest of the year. Here's the bottom line. Lousy jock that I was, I rose to the occasion under Coach Harkness. He was like no other I had experienced. He got inside our heads. Our horrible repetitive drills became fun. We learned new tricks of the trade by the bucket load, and we really got off on one another. As for me, I was transformed in the space of 2 or 3 weeks. He believed I had 2 or 3 or 10 times more potential than I'd ever exhibited, and he made me believe it. And on the first game of the second half of the season, I became a varsity starter with, my God, the confidence necessary to do the job. Thanks to Ned Harkness, I learned the meaning of great coaching, great practices, and performance that was orders of magnitude beyond what one could imagine one could do. Lesson. Great training is transformative. It can make you 10 times the player you were a short time before, and it actually changes you dramatically as a person. The brief time with Coach Harkness made me a rabid believer in training. Wrong. The time with Coach Harkness made me a rabid believer in excellent training. I'd love to tell you there was some ending in which I became an All-American and helped Cornell to a championship, but the truth is, although I made huge strides thanks to Ned's tutelage, the next coach saw me for what I was, not much of an athlete. I lived down to his expectations, playing ceased to be fun, and I ended up exiting the team in order to put more time in on my absurdly challenging engineering courses. But, those few months the prior year were joyous and a real eye-opener. More generally, and relative to the excellence dividend, I see training as anybody's or any organization's success practice number one. And I am utterly dismayed, stunned, even enraged when others don't see it the way I do. Moreover, I believe the training and preparation edge is 10 times or 100 times more important in the midst of the age of disruption and the tech tsunami in which we are embedded. With brand new threats and opportunities, there may be challenging questions about the nature of the training, but there can be no question whatsoever about its importance. This is the shortest chapter in the book. The training discussion was originally buried in Chapter 5, but I decided it was too important in 2018 to embed in something else. It needed to stand out and stand alone. After all, I argue here with all the passion I can muster that training is any firm's single most important capital investment. The Training Narrative 6.1 Train, 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 train. Quote, training, training, and more training, unquote. Admiral Chester Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief U.S. Pacific Fleet, communication to Chief of Naval Operations Ernest King in 1943. Fact, the United States Navy was woefully unprepared at the time of Pearl Harbor. The fix, training, training, and more training. I was never much of a game coach, but I was a pretty good practice coach. Basketball coach John Wooden, perhaps the best coach of anything ever. The will to succeed is important, but what's more important is the will to prepare. Bobby Knight, basketball coaching legend. 6.2. Training equals investment number one. In the Army, 3-star generals obsess about training. In most businesses, it's a ho-hum, mid-level staff function. Intensive and extensive and expensive and constant training is obvious for Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, football teams, baseball teams, archery teams, fire departments, police departments, theater companies, ballet companies, university academic departments, etc. In the military in particular, where the stakes are life and death, best training wins. No issue. So why the hell does best training wins not apply for the average business, and especially why not for the average small business? It just seems so damned obvious to me. Bottom line, training equals investment number one. Damn it. I have always thought training was important, but would not have said investment number one. My altered tune stems from the animating idea of this book. to meet the tech tide from which the book title is derived, training, writ large, soars to the top of the list of organizational and individual opportunities. 6.3. Training. Forever. Getting better and getting ready is an obsession of those moving to the top, and particularly those attempting to stay there. 1. Winston Churchill's rule of thumb. 1 hour of preparation for 1 minute of a speech. 2. Tom Peters. 2 weeks' work to get ready for a 45-minute speech. 3. Jerry Seinfeld. 6 months in small clubs to add 3 new minutes to a stand-up routine. 4. Abraham Lincoln. Give me 6 hours to chop down a tree, and I will spend the first 4 sharpening the axe. I acknowledge that I love the word training. Many prefer development or preparation. I get that. But when I think of my next speech, what I think about is, like football or theater, training. Then, after weeks of getting ready, that is, training, I set the alarm for and wake up at 3 a.m. on the morning of the speech. And from 3 a.m. to 6:30 a.m. when I go downstairs from my hotel room, I will make probably 200 or 300 more changes. Development, practice, prep, learning. Fine. But for me, perhaps idiosyncratically, those words are all part of training. Or, rather, and excuse the repetitiveness, training, 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 damn it. 6.4. The training queries. If not, why not? 1. Is your chief training officer, CTO, your top paid C-level job? Other than the CEO, COO. If not, why not? Of course, I know you probably don't even have a chief training officer. For shame. 2. Are your top trainers paid as much as and treated as well as your top marketers or top engineers? If not, why not? 3. Are your training courses so good that they make you tingle? If not, why not? Someone at a seminar challenged me on this last question, saying it was unrealistic. And by the way, what the hell does tingle mean? I pointed to my sophomore year in college. For engineers, an introductory chemistry course was required. Most of us looked forward to it as the equivalent of a 4-month-long root canal procedure. We had 2 well-known professors, Mitchell Cienko and Robert Plain. They were scholars of the first order, and, simultaneously, entertainers of the first order. Result, by the end of the course, probably half of us, among hundreds, wanted to be chemistry majors. That is, there are great teachers and great courses, and I do not understand why the corporate world can't develop or recruit the equivalents of the Ciencos and Planes. Billions upon billions of dollars and survival are at stake, and great on-payroll profs concocting great courses could do wonders for recruitment, retention, quality, innovation, and productivity. Companies spend megabucks recruiting computer science professors of great renown. Why not the same damn thing for top trainers? As to tingle, I'm looking for something beyond very good. I'll accept earth-shaking or mind-blowing or, for sure, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. 4. If you randomly stop an employee in the hall, can she or he describe in detail her or his development plan for the next 12 months? If not, why not? If the answer is no, her or his boss should be sternly reprimanded ASAP. I would say fired, but you might accuse me of being over the top. 6.5. Training. Gambling man. I'll bet a pretty penny. Bet 1. 5 of 10 CEOs see training as an expense rather than an investment. Bet 2. 5 of 10 CEOs see training as defense rather than offense. Bet 3. 5 of 10 CEOs see training as a necessary evil rather than a strategic opportunity. I'll bet many a pretty penny. Bet 4. 8 of 10 CEOs in a 45-minute tour d'horizon of their business would not mention training. It's bet number 4 that drives me around the bend. In that 45-minute conversation, the first 15 minutes would most likely be devoted to the changing environment and business conditions in general. Then about 15 minutes on strategy and, say, 10 minutes on seriously cool software that cost us $87 million. And there you have it. Okay, maybe the last 5 minutes on people, but I bet with ever so much certainty based on a tractor load of experience that during the 5 people minutes, which would focus on the quality of executives, there would not be one bloody reference to training. Damn it, damn it, damn it. 6.6. When times get tough, train. A positive exception to the rule. When a recession comes, most retailers cut way back on training to save money. Exception. In the last recession, Container Store doubled training for in-store customer contact employees. Perfect time, they said, for best effort with any customers who still come our way during the economic turmoil. And the best plausible path is to double down on helping our closest to the customer people grow. FYI, a few years ago, Container Store was ranked as the number one company to work for in the gigantic U.S. economy. 6.7. One more time. Training equals investment number one. What is the very best reason to go bananas over training? Greed. It pays off big time. And, contrary to conventional wisdom, damn near immediately. Axiom 1. Your, boss, job is much safer if every one of your team members is committed to training-led radical personal development. Axiom 2. The training imperative holds times 10 or times 100 for a small business. This is anything but a Fortune 500 thing. The last point should be unnecessary. If I have only 9 employees on my payroll, then each one of them is of surpassing strategic importance. A no-holds-barred effort to train and develop each of those 9 strategic pillars, people, should be as obvious as the end of one's nose. Alas, it is not. Often one hears that damnable, train them and they'll leave, or some other contemptible excuse. 9 people on your payroll, 9 peerless strategic opportunities, train, train, train. Chapter 7. Tech Tsunami, White Collar Apocalypse, The New Moral Imperative. Section 1. Tech Tsunami, White Collar Apocalypse. My Story. I was shopping on a rainy Thursday afternoon in March 2017. My wife called me while I was in the grocery store and said she had a problem, an opportunity for me, of course. We had guests coming Saturday for lunch, and she had just discovered that the vacuum bag was unusably full and that we were out of replacements. Did I have time to get some? I said, sure, finished the grocery run, went to the car, punched Home Depot in Dartmouth, Massachusetts into my GPS. A clerk pointed me in the right direction, but I soon discovered the bags I needed were not on the shelf. I caught the eye of another clerk, and he kindly agreed to take a look in the back and see if there might be some there. He was gone for 3 or 4 minutes, doubtless diligently searching. Though I appreciated his help and friendly attitude, this extra stop had me running late. Without thinking, really, I pulled my iPhone out of my pocket, went to my Amazon app, and punched in the vacuum bag specs. Needless to say, I found exactly what I wanted for less than the Home Depot price, and, thanks to Amazon Prime, It would arrive home tomorrow, Friday, leaving plenty of time for vacuuming. I felt badly that the clerk was trying to be helpful and that I was effectively stiffing him and skipping out. Nonetheless, after about 10 seconds of remorse, I pushed the one-click order button. While the estimate is approximate, I am dead certain that the entire transaction, from iPhone out of my pocket to iPhone back into my pocket, took no more than 90 seconds, including research. And off home I went. But wait, and off home I went has a non-trivial backstory, too. I'd probably been to Home Depot 20 times at least since my wife and I moved full-time from Tynmouth, Vermont, to Dartmouth, Massachusetts, about 2 years ago. Home Depot is only about 3 turns and 7 miles from our house. Nonetheless, I am unsure of the way home, including step one, coming out of the Home Depot parking lot. And so I went to my favorites on my Garmin GPS and punched in home. So? The so is this. When we moved, my wife, Susan, religiously eschewed her GPS. The simple fact is that she can find her way from here to there without a hitch, including odd corners of New Bedford or Fall River or wherever. I pride myself on my sense of direction. But when we got to Dartmouth, I was lazy and did a full Garmin. It is not an exaggeration, I dearly wish it were, to state that I can barely find my way out of our driveway. I am hardly alone. Recent research indicates that we GPSDs, GPS dependents, not only are perpetually lost, but also measurably lose our innate sense of direction. The GPS rewires our brains, and not in a good way. Technology is changing the world. The implications, especially for employment, are staggering. My little mini-sagas above pale by comparison. Or do they? The implications of the Home Depot story alone is affecting millions of retail jobs in the United States, from minimum wage greeters to $100,000 a year senior staff department folks. Disruption is a frightfully overused word, but Amazon and an increasing number of like firms are indeed disrupting a big share of the economy, from corner mom and pop shops to multi-hundred store chains and, by the score, the shopping centers in which they are embedded. As to the little GPS story, it foretells AI monkeying with our brains and changing the way we perceive the world. That's hardly a mini-saga. The Tech Tsunami Narrative 7.1.1 Mark Andreessen is dead certain. Software is eating the world. What follows is a brief collection of quotes that capture a wee bit of the state of play, until tomorrow when everything changes, in the topsy-turvy tech world. About 3 years ago, certain that I had fallen hopelessly behind, I started a crash reading program, now 100-plus books and no end in sight. In the end, I hardly felt expert. In fact, I was more confused than ever. But I had developed a relatively decent feel for the muddled state of play. Assuming you are not a major tech player, I urge you to consider launching a similar personal education program. Read, 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 read. Tom's Axiom 2018. Outread the buggers. The greatest shortcoming of the human race is our inability to understand the exponential function. Albert A. Bartlett. Very strong language. Greatest shortcoming. But I believe that physicist Bartlett has a critical point. The issue today is not change. It is the acceleration of the rate of change, that damnable exponential function. Big phase shifts used to come along every, say, 25 years. Now the number, experts mostly agree, may be every 5 years. The business implications are huge, and the social implications boggle the mind. Automation has become so sophisticated that on a typical passenger flight, a human pilot holds the controls for a grand total of just 3 minutes. Pilots have become, it's not much of an exaggeration to say, computer operators. Nicholas Carr, The Great Forgetting, The Atlantic. Showstopper for me, among the most frequent of frequent flyers. There are many pluses and at least one big negative. The latter. Pilots are losing their ability to respond to ambiguous emergencies. That's been the conclusion after several major crashes. The combination of new market rules and new technology was turning the stock market into, in effect, a war of robots. Michael Lewis, Goldman's Greek Tragedy, Vanity Fair. Welcome to the age of insta-crashes, mega-crashes, maniacal trading to no fruitful end, and so on. Despite stacks of regulations, it's fair to say no one is in charge. Guaranteed, Michael Lewis is a superb guide. Guaranteed, more, much more unimaginable craziness and instability is on the way. Almost all healthcare people get is going to be done, hopefully, by algorithms within a decade or two. Michael Vassar, MetaMed founder, quoted in New York Magazine. The process is well underway. For example, at one world-famous hospital in Greater Boston, MDs in some disciplines are not permitted to override the diagnostic conclusions spit out by the algorithms and big data. Let's welcome our newest board member. Just like other members of the board, the algorithm gets to vote on whether the firm makes an investment in a specific company or not. The program will be the sixth member of the DKV's board. From Business Insider, a venture capital firm just named an algorithm to its board of directors. Here's what it actually does. No joke, a formal member of the board of directors. Apparently, the algorithm's track record surpasses that of its human counterparts. Algorithms have already written symphonies as moving as those composed by Beethoven, picked through legalese with the deftness of a senior law partner, diagnosed patients with more accuracy than a doctor, written news articles with the smooth hand of a seasoned reporter, and driven vehicles on urban highways with far better control than a human. Christopher Steiner, Automate This: How Algorithms Took Over Our Markets, Our Jobs, and the World. Denial equals a punch in the nose. Mr. Steiner tells a tale of a classical music composing contest won by an algorithmically produced piece of music. At a subsequent high-level conference, the algorithm's creator was punched in the nose by a leading human composer. 7.1.2. Jobs apocalypse. Alarmism? Cold truth. Up to 35% of Britain's jobs will be eliminated by new computing and robotics technology over the next 20 years, say experts from Deloitte and Oxford University. Telegraph. 10 million jobs at risk from advancing technology. November 14th, 2014. A similar report featured on CNBC in March of 2016, citing Oxford academics Carl Benedict Fry and Michael A. Osborne, concluded that 50% of U.S. jobs were at high risk of being automated out of existence in the next two decades. Perhaps overstatement, perhaps understatement. That there are such estimates being seriously discussed is in itself extraordinary. There are experts who fall into a category generally called techno-optimists. They believe we will cope with the change, one talked of an innovation tsunami, and come out the other end whole. There are equally intelligent and seasoned techno-pessimists who have apocalyptic views. For what it's worth, and I in no way claim to be an expert, I view myself as leaning ever so slightly toward the techno-optimist end of the scale. In any case, the level of uncertainty is astronomical, and the implications are astronomical. 7.1.3. You're a professional. So what? The intellectual talents of highly trained professionals are no more protected from automation than is the driver's left turn. Nicholas Carr, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. If you think being a professional makes your job safe, Think again. Robert Reich. A bureaucrat is an expensive microchip. Dan Sullivan, consultant and executive coach. The last of these three quotes is a great laugh line, except it's not very funny for a staggering number of professional job holders. Message: the professions are not in any way, shape, or form safe from encroaching artificial intelligence. No, all the lawyers and docs and engineers won't disappear, but there will be, in rather short order, virtually unimaginable dislocation. Face it, professionals in medicine or law are, in a fashion, no different from chefs or window cleaners. A few are excellent, many are okay, and some number are marginal. Following a botched root canal, a top-flight dentist cleaning up the mess said to me, and I remember ever so clearly, "Remember, Tom, half the dentists graduated in the bottom half of their class." I laughed through the pain, but the one-liner contains non-trivial employment, or rather unemployment, consequences. 7.1.4. The Great Restructuring. The root of our problems is not that we are in a great recession or a great stagnation, but rather that we are in the early throes of a great restructuring. Our technologies are racing ahead, but our skills and organizations are lagging behind. Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee, Race Against the Machine. This slim volume by two MIT professors played an oversized role in helping me develop a point of view. Their analyses are clear, their conclusions are balanced, their pedigree is unassailable. Remember the term, great restructuring. 7.1.5. FYI, China 2, manufacturing employment down 30 million. From Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee, The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. Since 1996, manufacturing employment in China itself has actually fallen by an estimated 25%. That's over 30 million fewer Chinese workers in that sector, even while output soared by 70%. It's not that American workers are being replaced by Chinese workers in that sector. It's that both American and Chinese workers are being made more efficient, replaced by automation. Just one Chinese company, Foxconn, is in the process of installing 1 million new robots in the next 2 or 3 years. And one of its factories in Kunshan has already seen, courtesy of automation, employment plunge from 110,000 to 50,000. The straightforward story: this phenomenon is universal. It is not limited to high-wage settings, though China's urban wages are soaring. In China's case, too, the social and political consequences of worker dislocation caused by this trend, still picking up steam, boggles the mind. I do not have an answer. I do not even have a strong point of view. That is, I'm all over the map, sure of one thing one day, then something different the next. I've got a lot of company in that regard, even in the expert class. Something enormous is going down. You need not attempt to be an expert. You do need to try to be conversant in the great debate over the meaning of highly advanced AI. One more time. Read, 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 read. Read, study. Number one. The Second Machine Age. Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies, by Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee. Also, The Future of the Professions, How Technology Will Transform the World of Human Experts, by Richard Susskind and Daniel Susskind. The Industries of the Future, by Alec Ross. Superintelligence, Paths, Dangers, Strategies, by Nick Bostrom. Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future, by Martin Ford. Robot Futures, by Ilya Reza Nurbesh. The Glass Cage, Automation and Us, by Nicholas Carr. Dataism, The Revolution Transforming Decision-Making, Consumer Behavior, and Almost Everything Else, by Steve Lohr. Big Data, A Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think, by Victor Mayer Schoenberger and Kenneth Couquier. Glass Jaw, A Manifesto for Defending Fragile Reputations in an Age of Instant Scandal, by Eric Desenhall. Automate This, How Algorithms Came to Rule Our World, by Christopher Steiner. Predictive Analytics, The Power to Predict Who Will Click, Buy, Lie, or Die, by Eric Siegel. Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas, by Natasha Dow Shull. Glass Houses, Privacy, Secrecy, and Cyber Insecurity in a Transparent World, by Joel Brenner. Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era, by James Barrett. 7.1.6, Extreme Predictions Courtesy of Non-Extreme Commentators. The development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race. Stephen Hawking. AI is a fundamental existential risk for human civilization. Elon Musk. We think there could be a possibility where 95% of people won't be able to contribute to the workforce. Sam Altman, Y Combinator. Correct or incorrect, such utterances by serious students are definitely in the air. The point of these three quotes is not alarmism, but they do underscore the extreme, unprecedented, perhaps, uncertainty that marks the times. I also find it interesting that several of these most expert of the experts put science fiction at the top of their suggested reading lists. For example, Accelerando by Charles Strauss. Robopocalypse and Amped by Daniel Wilson. Mother of Storms by John Barnes. Parasites Like Us by Adam Johnson. Snow Crash and Cryptomnicon and Others by Neal Stephenson. Anything by William Gibson. 7.1.7. Case, AlphaGo Beats Go, Grandmaster. This technology is going to cut through the global economy like a hot knife through butter. It learns fast and largely on its own. It's widely applicable. It doesn't only master what it has seen, it can innovate. For example, some of the unheard-of moves by AlphaGo were considered beautiful by the grandmaster it beat. Limited AGI, artificial general intelligence, deep learning in particular, will have the ability to do nearly any job currently being done by human beings, from lawyers to judges, nurses to doctors, driving to construction, potentially at a grand master's level of capability. This makes it a buzzsaw. Very few people, and I mean very few, will be able to stay ahead of the limited AGI buzzsaw. It learns so quickly that the fate of people stranded in former factory towns gutted by free trade is likely to be the fate of the highest paid technorati. They simply don't have the capacity to learn fast enough or be creative enough to stay ahead of it. John Robb, on his blog Global Gorillas, March 12, 2016. First it was chess, which in retrospect was more or less straightforward. Computation speed per se was the not-so-secret sauce. Then came Jeopardy, far less rule-driven. Now the ultimate expression of abstraction. Go. The clause that most caught my eye was, some of the unheard-of moves made by AlphaGo were considered beautiful by the grand master it beat. Beautiful is a very big word. It gets to the heart of what it means to be human. 7.1.8. Grin and bear it. Much, much more to come. Grin. Genetics, plus robotics, plus informatics, plus nanotechnology, equals, question mark, question mark, question mark. 7.1.9. Addenda for this year, heck of it. The dull old